Life is shit. This is a podcast about the little things we can do to make it less so. Roll our eyes and think, bankers, bit naughty, aren't they? Helping rich people pay a bit less tax and paying themselves big bonuses. Honestly. My aim with this podcast is to prove that bankers aren't naughty. They're not lovable rogues with Leonardo DiCaprio's face. They're what the scum of the earth call the scum of the earth. They're evil psychopaths with no thought for anyone but themselves. We shouldn't be rolling our eyes at what they do. We should be nailing these fuckers to crosses and setting their balls on fire. But I'm getting ahead of myself. First, there's a question to get out of the way. Who the hell am I to be talking about banking? Am I a retired banker? A financial journalist, perhaps? Someone with a PhD in economics, at least? No, I'm a bloke. A bloke who did A-levels in pure and applied maths, and a bloke who's been sub-editing the financial pages of a national newspaper for 5 years, but, by and large, a bloke who, 2 months ago, knew little more than the next man about the workings of finance. But consider for a moment what happens when bankers talk about banking.
Thanks, Kelly, and good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining Ewan and I. On the Exit Bank, you know our well-established track record in this area, and we have carried through into the Q1 with successful sale of our further tranche at Citizens, reducing our holdings to nearly 40%, announcing the sale of our international wealth business, the start of the disposals within CIB, and continued accelerated asset reduction in RCR. Our capital build continues with a 30 basis point rise in core Tier 1 ratio to 11.5% thanks to continued RWA reduction, and keeps us comfortably on track to reduce RWAs below our £300 billion target we've set ourselves for the end of this year.
That was Royal Bank of Scotland boss Ross McEwan talking to analysts in a conference call on the bank's first quarter earnings earlier this year. Well, okay, it wasn't Ross McEwan, it was my friend Oren Gruenbaum pretending to be Ross McEwan, but that's genuinely what he said. Bankers, and most financial journalists, talk in jargon, language that is deliberately obscure and exclusive. When they talk this way, people switch off and think, well, I'll never understand this, so I might as well not listen at all. Making banking sound fiendishly complex suits their agenda, because if no one else can be bothered to figure out how it works, then the bankers can continue to get away with the acts of breathtaking robbery, fraud and evil that they've been perpetrating for the last 30 or more years. And the thing is, I have a bank account. I earn money, I save money, I borrow money. The interest rate affects me, the income tax rate affects me, inflation affects me, and I use public services, the fate of which is intimately bound up with that of the banks. That makes banking my business, and it makes it your business as well. And frankly, what with this never-ending recession and public services being slashed, libraries closing, streets filling with homeless people and house prices going through the roof and all this shit with Greece, I was beginning to get sick of not understanding any of it. So I did a bit of reading. And you know what? Finance really isn't that hard to get your head round. You don't even need to be very good at maths. After a few weeks, I have a pretty good understanding of how the economy works, and specifically of how it's all gone to shit. Some of what I found out shocked me. Virtually all of it depressed me. And now I'd like to shock and depress you too. Now I'm going to assume a dunce level of comprehension of economics for this podcast, so apologies if you're already familiar with the basics. One of the first things I discovered during my research was how the Conservative Party pulled off the most audacious deception in modern politics, to convince the electorate that the Labour Party was somehow to blame for the last recession. There's one rather glaring piece of evidence that suggests this isn't true. It was a worldwide recession, not just a UK-wide one. The Tories really expect us to believe that Labour was so economically incompetent that they triggered a recession in every country on the planet. The plain fact is, if the Tories had been in power when the bust came, things would have been just as bad. There's only one candidate to blame for the crash of 2007, and that is the banks. Sure, other people had a hand in it, such as earlier governments, including Labour, who relaxed banking regulations to create the environment in which the crash could take place. But without a shadow of a doubt, the main culprits behind this crash, and virtually every other crash, were the sweaty supervillains in Savile Row suits. Before I tell you why, I'll need to explain how the banking system works. And I thought, rather than read out lines from an economics textbook, I'd write a little sketch.
Hey, person. Dry those tears. What's the matter?
Oh, hi. It's just that I've got these 100 pennies. I don't want to spend them all now, but I've got nowhere safe to keep them. I don't know what to do.
Well, I could look after them for you.
Really? You'd do that? But where are you going to put them?
Well, I happen to have a very sturdy box, and I could put them in there for you if you like. And whenever you need some, you can come and ask me, and I'll give them to you.
That sounds great.
Thing is, it's a bit of a waste all that money just sitting there, so I might not put all of them in the box.
What are you going to do with them, then?
Lend them to someone.
Why would you want to do that?
Because I'm going to make her pay me back more pennies than she borrowed. I think I'll call it interest.
So you're making a profit from my money?
Your money, my money, whatever. Well, it's only fair, isn't it? I mean, I am letting you use my sturdy box.
I suppose. So, she's a reliable person, is she, this woman? Creditworthy?
Well, here's the thing. If people are reliable and are likely to pay me the money back, I can't charge them much interest. But if they're unreliable and less likely to pay me back, I can charge them loads.
But you're going to put the rest of the pennies in your sturdy box, right?
Actually, no. Most of the rest I'm going to gamble.
You're going to use my money to gamble?
Yep. I'm going to bet on the value of bonds, stocks, commodities and currencies.
So you're good at gambling, right?
Not especially. Even the most powerful computer programs in the world can't correctly predict which way things are going to go. Statistically, I'm no better than a blindfolded monkey throwing darts at the financial pages.
Then why on earth do you do it?
Because essentially you can't lose. The value of everything on average tends to go up, so there's practically no such thing as a bad bet.
You at least play it safe, right? And only bet on things you think are most likely to increase in value.
Well, no. It's like the loans. The potential return on safe bets is low. The riskier the bet, the higher the potential return. And since I've decided that my pay is going to go up and down with my performance, I think I'll call that a bonus. I want to try and earn as much as possible, which means making the riskiest bet.
But it is possible to lose, right?
Well, that almost never happens. Only if there's some unexpected catastrophe, like American house prices falling slightly in value, or Russia defaulting on its debt, or Greece leaving the Eurozone.
But unexpected catastrophes happen all the time. Like all the things you just mentioned.
Yeah, well, it doesn't really matter. Because if there is a disaster and I lose everything, the government will just step in and rescue me. So I'll stop lending to people and cripple the economy, and public services will suffer horribly, and you might lose your job. But it won't really affect me, because I'll have paid myself £11.5 million a year out of profits from the good times.
So, to recap, you're using my money to lend to unreliable people and make enormously risky bets.
Uh-huh.
You give yourself bonus payments based on profits, and the government steps in and bails you out if you lose it all.
Yep.
So you have absolutely zero incentive to play it safe. And every incentive to risk everything.
Correct.
Just out of interest, how many of my 100 pennies are you going to keep in your sturdy box?
Three. Damn it. The government's just changed the laws, so now I have to keep 4 of them in the box. Bastards.
Well, if you're using my money to make money, shouldn't I at least get a share of the proceeds? You're charging interest to people who borrow from you. Since you're technically borrowing from me, shouldn't you pay interest to me too?
Insane.
Thanks ever so much to the unfairly talented Bryony Redman for helping out there. Now, I must admit that sketch was hugely inaccurate in one important respect. There are no senior women bankers, because as well as being deeply corrupt, banking is also one of the most sexist professions on the planet. Now, the state of affairs we just depicted may not seem very fair, but it's pretty much how things have always been. The Greek philosopher Aristotle declared that usury, the practice of lending money for profit, was immoral. So did the Bible. So did the Quran. But the plain fact is, all modern finance, the entire edifice of capitalist economics, is based on usury, lending people money and charging them interest. It's true that that sketch was a slightly romanticised explanation of the banking system. That's how it's supposed to work. That's how economics is taught in schools. The truth, as a memo from the Bank of England revealed last year, is slightly scarier. Because what actually happens is that when a bank extends credit, it creates money out of thin air. Say you ask a bank for a loan of £100. The bank just makes some changes to its electronic database, and it now has £100 in assets, and you have £100 to spend. Now, what you'll probably do is pay that £100 into another bank account. That gives your bank, or another bank, £100. Assuming that bank has a leveraging ratio of 10%, i.e. it's allowed to lend out 10 times as much as it has in assets, then it can now lend out another £90 to another person, who will deposit that in another bank, and so on and so forth, until there's a whole new £1,000 in the economy. More money in the economy means more liquidity, more transactions, and more transactions means more lovely tax. Basically, the health of the economy is all about the speed of transactions. Money that's stationary, money that's bound up in savings, in property, in things, isn't much good to anyone. In a healthy economy, money keeps moving. For this reason, debt, or as the banks have so ingeniously rebranded it, credit, basically is the economy. In fact, the leveraging ratio for banks in this country, until recently, was 3%, so it should come as no surprise that about 97% of the money currently in circulation in the UK is, in fact, debt. If everyone were, by some miracle, to pay off all their debts tomorrow, the amount of money available would dwindle to almost nothing. No wonder, then, that the banks are so keen to get us all into debt. No wonder they're sending us letters imploring us to take out credit cards every week and goading us into taking out huge mortgages. Never mind that the more indebted we are, the unhappier we are. Never mind that greater debt correlates with greater marital conflict, greater stress, more illness, both mental and physical. Banks want us to be in as much debt as possible, because it's how they make the most money. Governments want us to be in as much debt as possible because it means more tax. Of course, there's one small problem with building your banking system, and by extension most of your economy, on debt. In prosperous times, it doesn't matter if the odd person defaults on their loan, as the amount of interest bankers and their investors are getting from all their other creditors more than makes up for it. But when times get tough and lots of people stop repaying, the system falls to bits. And if you're constantly strong-arming people into taking out more debt and charging them ever greater amounts of interest, then at some point, times are going to get tough. The fact is, people frequently need more money than they have to invest in big infrastructure projects, to start up companies and so on. And they can't do that without loans. And you can't expect people to lend money if there's nothing in it for them. Now, I'm no raging communist. I happen to think that capitalism, while hugely flawed, is the best system anyone's come up with yet. So I'm not suggesting we tear it all down. Besides, it's not exactly the banker's fault, is it? They may be slightly overzealous in encouraging people to get into debt, but they didn't design this system. It's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it. So it might as well be the people with no discernible sense of humour, right? Well, that would be true if that were all that bankers did. The trouble is, it's not. It's time to introduce an important distinction, or rather, what should be an important distinction. On the one hand, your high street banks, your Lloyds's, your Barclays's, your HSBC's, whose main job, originally at least, was as outlined above. These all began by practicing retail banking, looking after deposits and giving loans to individuals, and commercial banking, providing the same services for companies. Then, on the other hand, you have your investment banks, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan Chase. Investment banks do lots of different things, but their main function is to help businesses and individual clients raise capital. Raising capital being their euphemism for raking in shitloads of cash. They might do this by underwriting mergers and acquisitions, but their main activity is to buy and sell shares, currencies, commodities, and financial derivatives. Because all these things can go up and down in value, it is, to all intents and purposes, gambling. Gambling, obviously, is risky. In boom times, these investment banks would often make their customers, and through hefty fees themselves, immensely wealthy. But if there was a crash, they could lose everything. Investment banking is just one component, albeit probably the largest component, of what's called the shadow banking system. Companies and individuals who provide financial services, but who are not part of commercial banks. Because they're not commercial banks, they're not bound by the same regulations and safeguards. Now, at some point, the commercial banks looked at the investment banks and thought, huh, they work with money, and we work with money, but they make loads more than we do, and they wanted a slice of the pie. So, one by one, they started piling in. And after a while, they joined in so wholeheartedly that it was almost impossible to tell high street banks and investment banks apart. That was all fine and dandy, as long as the economy was growing. But when the Wall Street crash came in 1929, and the investment banks made huge losses, the regular banks, being so deeply enmeshed in the same activities, made huge losses too. Now, of course, if high street banks go under, then all the people and companies saving with them go under too. So the government had to step in and rescue them, or bail them out. The US government's response to this crisis was to pass the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, which basically redrew the thick black line between commercial banking and investment banking, so that if there was ever another crash, individual wealthy investors might suffer, but you and I, and small businesses, would not. But despite the lesson of 1929, for the next 70 years, banks persistently lobbied governments to be allowed to play in the casino again. There were concessions and concessions, and then eventually in 1999, President Clinton effectively repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, so that banks were free to get up to their old tricks again. Similar legislation followed across the Western world. The extent to which this actually caused the crash of 2007 is debatable, but it sure as hell made its effects more devastating. Once again, the retail banks had their noses so deep in the investment bank's trough that when it caught fire, they got burned. Many banks went under. The rest needed huge bailouts at the taxpayers' expense. You may have heard people using the phrase, too big to fail. This doesn't just mean that the financial institutions are too big, but that they're all too interconnected. If one goes down, they all go down. The added problem here is that the banks now know they are too big to fail, and that if there's another financial catastrophe, governments will have no choice but to step in again. This means they have no interest in playing it safe with their money, our money, and continue to engage in high-risk, high-reward activities. So the bank structure exacerbated the effects of the crash. But what actually caused it? Well, there are a number of contributory factors, including China overinvesting in US government bonds, US house prices dropping by 20% in a year. But most experts agree there was one overriding cause. Financial derivatives are not assets in themselves, like commodities, currencies, and bonds. They are instead a financial instrument that is derived from an asset. The following sketch will probably be no help at all.
Clive! Clive! I've got it! The new financial instrument we've been looking for!
How does it work?
I've no idea.
What?
Well, look, you know how in the beginning we trade in our assets that are real, or almost real, like commodities, oil, gold, pork bellies, currencies, government bonds and shares?
Yeah.
But then we invented derivatives, which are abstractions based on real assets, like options.
A contract given the right, but not the obligation to buy or sell an asset at a future date.
Futures.
A contract obligating us to buy or sell an asset at a future date.
Swaps.
Allowing people to exchange interest rates or securities.
Well, I've invented the heffalump. It's the right to buy or sell the insurance on your counterparty's debt, which you're obligated to swap with someone else after tranching and transferring the credit risk to a third party, but only on the second Tuesday of the month and if you're wearing yellow.
But that sounds like nonsense.
Exactly.
Huh?
Look, the trouble with real things like pork bellies and dollars is they're concrete. Their value never really goes up or down much. There's no volatility. But with derivatives, it's much harder to determine their value because they're complex, so the risks involved are greater, and thus the price is more volatile. And what does more volatility mean?
Bigger profits.
Quite.
And also technically bigger losses.
Now, the heffalump is so obscenely complex, it's almost impossible for anyone to work out what its value is at any one time. Any change in any element could see it rise or fall massively in price, which means the volatility is enormous, unlimited even, and as a result, so are the profits.
And the losses. You, my friend, are a genius. Just one thing. What about regulators? Won't they clamp down on it?
That's the best thing about it. You see, it's so fiendish, they'll never be able to understand it. And they can't very well regulate something they don't understand, can they?
Someone buy this man an island.
Oh, not another one.
Thanks again to Bryony Redman. It's true that some financial instruments are so complex that even those trading in them don't fully understand them. But the basic principle is simple enough. Derivatives are basically contracts, or promises to honour a trade at a future date. There are three main types: futures, options, and swaps. Say a farmer is expecting a harvest of grain in the autumn. If she's worried that the price people are willing to pay for her grain might go down, she can try to negotiate a future contract now, whereby a buyer promises to pay an agreed sum at a fixed date. Once this contract is signed, it can be traded. So if another buyer thinks the value of grain is going to rise before the agreed date, they might try to buy this contract from the first buyer, because they will then have grain at a bargain price. Derivatives have been mostly used as a way of managing risk, of hedging your bets. They've been around for centuries, but their use really took off in the 1970s, when the advent of computers enabled high volumes of high-speed calculations. When automated trading took off in the 90s, they were really off to the races. Traders started devising ever more new and exotic forms of derivative: tender option bonds, variable rate demand notes, equity volatility swaps. Before long, the trading world was doing more business in derivatives of assets than it was in the assets themselves. In the years leading up to the crash, the total value of derivative trades was estimated to be around 10 times the entire GDP of the world. The problem with derivatives is that they're mostly traded by the shadow banking sector. As such, they're not closely monitored or regulated, and there's no easy way of following all the sales. This means that huge amounts of risk can build up undetected in certain areas. In 1994, a bright young spark at JP Morgan invented a derivative called a credit default swap. I'll bet the bleeder was as pleased as punch with himself. Say you make a loan to someone on which they're going to pay you lots of lovely interest, but you're vaguely worried that that person won't pay you back. So what you do is find a third party who will, in exchange for a percentage of the interest, promise to honour that loan in the event of default. Essentially, they are insuring you against the loss of the loan. Suddenly, you can't lose. Your profits take a small hit, but essentially, you're golden. Either the second party pays back the loan, or it defaults, and the third party pays back the loan. Meanwhile, the insurers are onto a good thing too, because they have a great income stream without really having to do anything, other than promise to pay in the event of default, which is generally pretty rare. This new instrument proved insanely popular. Suddenly, everyone thought they could lend out money at no risk whatsoever. So that's exactly what they did. It didn't matter how much they lent, because they were guaranteed to get it back from one source or another. At some point, the banks found they were running out of people who wanted loans. They needed new creditors. Now, there were a lot of people in the US who didn't own their own homes. Poorer people. Why not offer them loans? Because they were a big credit risk, you could charge them sky-high rates of interest and still be insured against default. So banks and mortgage lenders, crazed with greed, started aggressively approaching people without regular incomes, people without any incomes, and offering them huge stacks of cash. Never mind that they would never be able to pay it back. Besides, because property prices always go up, and the mortgages were secured against property, they could always get their money back off the value of the house. These subprime loans seemed like a dream ticket. By the end of 2007, the market in credit default swaps was worth an estimated $62.2 trillion. And because everyone, including the banks themselves, was snapping up credit default swaps, these risky loans were flooding the system. And then one day, house prices dropped. Suddenly, lots of people couldn't afford the repayments on their loans and defaulted. So many people, in fact, that the insurers who had indemnified these loans couldn't honour their guarantees. So the insurers started to go bust. That, in turn, put the banks in trouble, and they weren't helped by the fact that most of them had piled in on the credit default swap action too. And so the banks started to go under. Then governments had to step in to rescue the retail banks, and banks stopped lending money, the money supply dried up, and we were thrown into the worst depression in living memory. It was 1929 all over again. So the bankers caused a couple of economic depressions. Can't we just give them a slap on the wrist and tell them not to do it again? Well, we could. But they will. They say those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it. Clearly, no banker ever studied economic history, because bankers repeat their mistakes every 6 to 7 years. From Dutch tulip mania in 1637, to the South Sea bubble of 1720, to the panic of 1819, to Black Friday in 1869, to the panic of 1873, to the panic of 1893, to the Florida real estate craze of 1926, to the Wall Street crash of 1929, to Black Friday in 1987, to the Russian bond default of 1998, to the dot-com bubble of 2000, every major economic disaster in history has been caused by the greed of bankers.
But, like, why'd you have to keep harping on about the crashes, man? I mean, in between the crashes, we do loads for the economy.
That was obviously a banker. Okay, for the sake of argument, we'll forgive you the mass unemployment, the devastating effects on public services, the casting of millions into poverty, and the huge rise in suicide rates. Instead, let's talk about your pay. From the 1940s to the early 1980s, if you worked in banking, you could expect to earn the median wage. Right in the middle, a bit more than a nurse, a bit less than a teacher. Fast forward 35 years, and the picture is rather different. The average wage in the UK today is about £27,000 a year. But if you're in finance, you'll earn on average 50 grand, almost twice that. And as soon as you start going up the hierarchy, the numbers become jaw-dropping. This year, Antonio Horta Addario, Chief Executive Officer of Lloyds Banking Group, which was bailed out in 2008 and is still 20% owned by the British taxpayer, earned £11.5 million. That's exactly 1,000 times the minimum wage, which well over a million people in this country are earning. It's 430 times the average wage in the UK. Let's say you're at the top of your game for 16 years. That's £172 million. With your previous earnings, your golden hello, your golden handshake and your pension, you're probably looking at over £200 million in career earnings. Here's a list of some of the things you can do with £200 million. Have 20 children and send them all to the finest schools in the world for 200 years. Buy a mansion in the capital city of every nation in the world. Sleep with a different high-class prostitute every night for 1,000 years. Bathe in the finest champagne every night for 200 years. There's no two ways about it. Paying one person this amount of money isn't just wrong. It's fucking obscene. Now, you might say someone else's pay packet is none of our business, but there are a number of reasons we should care. First, every penny in their pockets ultimately comes out of ours. Antonio Horta Osorio's 11.5 million is why we no longer get interest on our current accounts, or even our savings accounts. Antonio Horta Osorio's 11.5 million pounds is why bank charges are higher, meaning higher prices. Antonio Horta Osorio's 11.5 million is why banks are continually hassling us, either misleadingly or illegally, to buy worthless things like payment protection insurance and interest rate swaps. Second, this sort of pay disparity has a negative effect on the nation's economy. So fat now are the rewards to be had from banking that many young people, faced with the choice between becoming a teacher, taking a week's holiday in Skegness once a year and quite possibly never owning their own home, or becoming a banker, being able to buy enough cocaine to ski in, shooting poor people for sport at the weekends and retiring at 38, are, perhaps understandably, choosing finance. So now many of our finest minds, instead of training as a doctor or an engineer or an artist and benefiting society, are embarking on a career in destroying it. Third, huge pay disparities are unfair and unhealthy. They're bad in the workplace, where, as well as breeding resentment, they undermine teamwork and encourage reckless risk-taking and cheating. But they're even worse for society at large. It's been proven by psychologists that happiness depends not on the absolute amount of money you have, but on the amount of money you have relative to those around you. Study after study shows that the more unequal a society is, the lower the level of trust and public-spiritedness, and the higher the rate of child abuse, bullying, crime, mental illness, drug addiction, disease, teenage pregnancy, violence, obesity and imprisonment. Greater inequality leads to shorter spells of economic expansion and more frequent and severe cycles of boom and bust. One of the fundamental tenets of right-wing political theory of recent decades is trickle-down economics, the idea that helping the wealthiest people helps society as a whole. But every piece of research that's been carried out in this area has proven it to be wrong. Even a cursory glance at the figures proves that inequality is growing rather than shrinking. In 1965, chief executive officers of companies on average earned 18 times as much as the average person. In the year 2000, they earned 400 times as much as the average person. Over the last 40 years, CEOs have seen their incomes rise by over 700%, while the rest of us have barely kept pace with inflation. One reason for the failure of trickle-down is that we're now paying the top bankers and CEOs so much, they literally can't spend it. Instead, they're investing it in shares and property, which incidentally is driving up house prices and rents so that fewer and fewer people can afford to buy a house. Sure, they're creating wealth for themselves and their rich investor cronies, but since they don't spend it and exploit every possible loophole to avoid paying tax, the trickle-down is barely a drip. According to Barack Obama, income inequality is the defining challenge of our times. Pope Francis has stated that inequality is the root of social ills. In March this year, the UK's Office for National Statistics published a document saying, "What makes most difference to personal well-being is the level of individuals' income relative to those around them." The OECD, the IMF, the CBI, and even some Tories recognise that excessive inequality is a bad thing. Bankers are very fond of quoting Adam Smith to support their case, particularly the bit in The Wealth of Nations about the invisible hand of the market, the idea that governments shouldn't meddle in business because the markets are naturally efficient. What they tend to quote less often is the bit about how the free market only works if true competition exists, rather than cartels, or the point about how accumulating capital is only good for society if you reinvest it, not sit on it like Tolkien's dragon, or the bit about the equitable distribution of the profits throughout society. So, what happens if the gulf just keeps on getting wider? Well, even the Daily Telegraph suggested that growing economic inequality was one of the main causes of the riots of 2011. I strongly doubt whether that will be the last time in my lifetime that we see burning cars in the streets of London. So how do bankers attempt to justify their absurd pay packages How can you defend earning 400 times as much as someone else? Here are some of the excuses they've come up with.
We're providing an important service to society. We create money. We boost the country's GDP.
True, this is quite an important service. Although arguably not as important a service as that provided by, say, farmers or doctors or the police, who were all paid considerably less. And it's worth pointing out that bankers' pay has grown at a rate that has far outstripped the rise in GDP.
We work really hard.
That's as maybe. But do you work 400 times as hard? Are you working 16,000-hour weeks?
Banking is highly complex and requires very high intelligence.
Well, this one's plainly bullshit. A 2002 study of IQ scores across different professions found that bankers were only fractionally more intelligent than high school teachers and finished below engineers, IT experts, social scientists, lawyers, professors and doctors. Besides, if they're so bloody clever, how come none of them predicted the crash in 2007? Or indeed any other crash, and hemorrhaged billions of pounds in a matter of minutes? It's been proven many times over that when it comes to speculating on the stock market, bankers, on average, perform no better than chance. Successful predictions of the movements of the market are down to blind luck. The only reason any of them make a profit is that on average, the value of things tends to go up. The belief of traders and fund managers that they are using skill to beat the market is a cognitive illusion. And remember, most trades are carried out between bankers. So if one banker makes a purchase that turns out to be a good one, i.e. the commodity he bought gains in value, the banker who sold it to him made an equally stupid sale. One of the main foundations of modern economic thought is the idea of rational economic man, the theoretical trader who always has perfect information and always makes the perfect decision. The trouble is, as the succession of crashes has proven, we don't have perfect information, and the self-interested decision doesn't always benefit the group as a whole. Rational economic man is a dribbling idiot. The bottom line is, the only reason bankers earn more money than the rest of us is that they work right next to the money. They're like gold miners who are paid a good wage for mining the gold, but still stuff as much of it as they can into their pants every night before they clock off. Bankers are monkeys in a money tree. They have no real idea what they're doing, but because they occasionally, by sheer chance, make the correct decision, they reward themselves for their genius by pocketing the majority of it. Believe it or not, bankers still have a line of defence here. I mean, it's not as if we could say they deliberately caused all these crashes. And as for pay, well, they don't set their own salaries. We have to blame shareholders for that. It's just the way things work. We can't really blame them for anything, can we? Well, here are just some of the scandals and disasters caused by bankers' deliberate deception and raw greed from the last 25 years. The savings and loan crisis of the late 80s and 90s. The criminal activities and collapse of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International in 1991. Rogue trader Nick Leeson, who lost over $1 billion for Barings Bank in 1993, leading to the collapse of the bank. Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme of the 1990s and 2000s. Rogue trader Yasuo Hamanaka, whose decade of fraud and forgery cost the Sumitomo Corporation $2.6 billion. The collapse of Enron in 2001. Yes, Enron was an energy company, but it was traders who did most of the damage. Merrill Lynch, JP Morgan Chase and Citigroup's aiding and abetting of securities fraud in the late 1990s. The LIBOR rigging scandal from 2003 onwards. The PPI mis-selling scandal of 2005 onwards. JP Morgan Chase and Chase Bank's unfair credit card billing practices from 2005 onwards. Mortgage fraud, excessive risk-taking and bad loans at HBOS before its enforced takeover and bailout. The rigging of the foreign exchange from the mid-2000s. The multiple violations in and collapse of auction rate securities from 2006. The rigging of interest rates from 2007. If there's a rate, they'll rig it. The collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008. Rogue trader Jerome Kerviel, who in 2008 was convicted of forgery and unauthorized use of a bank's computers in trades that lost his bank $5 billion. The Repo 105 abuses of the late 2000s. Insider trading at the Galleon Group hedge fund in the late 2000s. Countrywide financials mortgage fraud in 2009. The Bank of America and Merrill Lynch merger bonus scandal of 2009. Foreclosure gate 2010. HSBC's failure in the late 2000s to implement anti-money laundering controls, allowing Mexican drug money and Iranian terrorist cash to enter the US. Standard Charter's violations of sanctions with Iran, Sudan, Libya and Burma. Rogue trader Kweku Adeboli, who lost and lied about $2 billion in 2011. Rogue trader Bruno Ixil, also known as the London Whale, who lost and lied about over $6 billion in 2012. There are two points to make about this list. First, it's not even close to exhaustive. This is just some of the stuff we've caught them doing. Jesus only knows what other scams these coke-addled vampires have got clean away with. Second, these aren't isolated incidents. For the most part, these were widespread, institutionalised abuses across the industry, much of which went on for a decade or more before being exposed. Every time one of these cases comes to light, the defence is always the same.
But everyone was doing it.
And as for all those rogue traders, I'm starting to think rogue trader would be a more apposite description of a banker who doesn't habitually lie, cheat and steal. Reckless risk-taking and corruption are endemic. Banking is rotten to the core. Of course, now that we've figured out that it was the banker's greed and cowardice that caused the crash, and a broken system that encourages corruption and massive risk-taking hugely magnified the effects of the crash, the world's governments have stepped in to stop it happening again, right? They've identified who was responsible and jailed them, taken steps to break up the banks, beefed up the regulators. Well, kinda. They've given the financial regulator a couple of teeth. They've tried, mostly in vain, to cap bankers' bonuses. And they've increased the leveraging ratio from 3% to 4%. But rogue traders aside, hardly anyone has been brought to account for either the crash or any of the scandals I just listed. And as soon as the economy picks up, you can bet your bottom dollar that the cycle will begin again. The bankers, now so rich that they can simply buy political influence, and so powerful that they can win concessions just by threatening to headquarter themselves in another country, will lobby for more freedoms, again, and be given them, and then probably begin to abuse them, again. And they'll take too many risks, and then suddenly one day someone will realise there's too much risk, and there'll be another crash, and the governments will have to bail them out, again, and so on, ad infinitum. So I'm afraid it's up to us. Unfortunately, banks are a necessary evil. Evil here being exactly the right word. We can't just store all our excess money under our beds and borrow when we need to from sharply dressed people of Italian extraction. We can't function without banks, but we don't have to accept them in their present warts and nothing else form. We don't have to accept that greed is good, and hey, while we're at it, why not throw in pride, lust, gluttony, sloth, wrath and envy as well? We can vote with our notes. We can invest in smaller, greener, less greedy banks. Or you can save with credit unions, or building societies, or community development finance institutions. For a list of some of the alternatives, visit moveyourmoney.org. In 2009, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, said, "If banks are too big to fail, then they're too big. Let's take our 100 pennies out, people, and make them smaller." Big yellow bunches of thanks to improviser, comedy writer and actor Bryony Redman. She's at Bryony Red with an I on Twitter and is available for work through www.dittoproductions.co.uk. To Oren Grunbaum, he's Oren Grunbaum at The Guardian, and to the Cog Art Space in Haggerston, London for letting me use their space, as well as for putting on some cracking improv and comedy shows. If you're interested in the stuff you've heard and you want to read more, see the link on their website.